Tango Tango Papa 1848, June 30th, 2014.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Tucumcari, New Mexico. There's been quite a number of days that have elapsed since the last podcast. I hadn't intended for that to happen. However, I took my time off. I've been home for the past several days. Came back to work today. And I had fully intended to record a podcast, at least one, while I was home, but it just never did happen. And, it wasn't for lack of time. I could have done it, but I don't know. My parents are there. By the way, my parents are doing much better, and they're still not completely recovered, but they're doing way better now, and so I spent a lot of time hanging out with them, and I just kind of felt like not doing much of anything. I didn't spend very much time at all online in any forms. I looked at the phone here and there and what have you and played with it a little bit, but wasn't really on the computer per se very much at all, and so I just relaxed. So, and I, the same way, of course, I didn't put up any videos while I was at home. I think I put one up while I was home, and so just use the time to more or less unplug and relax. And so now I'm back at work, and so I'll start back with the daily videos as much as I possibly can, and back to recording podcasts. Anyway, while I was home, I ended up, of course, I subscribed to Hulu Plus, which I'm still really liking. They have lots of documentaries from the BBC primarily, and they've even got some, I think I've seen some from the CBC, as well as Australia, I think it's ABC, Australia, Australia Broadcasting Company or Corporation. I don't know what the acronym stands for, but there's actually an ABC for Australia, not to be confused with ABC in the United States. So, but in any case, I ended up watching several different documentaries about animal behavior and so on and so forth, particularly about flocking, animals, various kinds of animals will sort of flock together. They're sort of part of the herd. You can have a school of fish or a shoal, as it's often called, of fish, or a herd of, wildebeests, for example, or a flock of birds. And all of these words kind of stand for the same sort of thing. You have kind of the group. Penguins do it. You have kind of this massive group of whatever animal it is, whatever type of animal it is, and they all sort of just kind of hang out together. And whenever the group begins to move, and it happens in the insect world too, is bees and ants and so on and so forth, and sort of collective behavior. And as long as the the, you know, an individual animal, as long as it doesn't stray too far from the pack or too far from the flock or whatever, as long as it doesn't stray too far, then it's relatively safe, and so on and so forth. But the problem, you know, in animals, this is, it's fascinating because with ants, for example, an individual ant seems kind of, you know, they're sort of stupid and they're, you know, relatively speaking, and they're sort of programmed to do whatever it is that they do, depending on the species. But collectively, and it's the same way with bees, collectively they can kind of make a decision. And, you know, and it's interesting, you know, at least the parts that they figured out, you know, with ant behavior, or more particularly bee behavior, as a group behavior, they've sort of figured out what, you know, the different types of things that they're communicating back and forth with each other and so on and so forth. And it's quite interesting, and it's extremely complicated. And it obviously, it's there are many aspects of this kind of behavior that we as human beings simply are not aware of, and so that's why it's they continue to study these things and make documentaries about them and so on and so forth, and document their behavior, and it's very interesting. It's actually extremely interesting. But the problem, there are some problems with, you know, and human beings will often point at this and they think, oh, that must be good because the animals are flocking together and so therefore there's safety in numbers and so on and so forth. But there's some problems with it. And predators will typically, different types of predators will try to isolate or cut off part of the group. Isolate them so that they're isolated from the main pack of the animals, and then they can pick them off one by one. It's much easier. But human beings are not meant to be animals in the same way that we do have these animal bodies. But we're not meant to be animals in the same way that bees are, or ants, or wildebeests, so on and so forth. We're just not. We're not meant to be those kind of creatures. But however, all you have to do to get human beings to sort of to begin to exhibit flocking sort of behavior in human being terms is to separate them from, for lack of a better way of describing it, potential God-given identity. And if you've listened to me any length of time, human beings are the only creature on this planet that have a choice. We have a choice as to what we will be. As far as an identity goes, we have a choice. An ant doesn't have a choice. It's an ant. A bee doesn't have a choice. It's just a bee. And it's part of the bee collective, and the ant is part of the ant collective, and it's part of the colony. And a wildebeest is part of the wildebeest herd. And a school of, you know, you have an individual fish that, you know, it's just part of the school of fish. You know, there are different types of fish that sort of school together. Same way with birds. And various types of birds. And they are what they are. And they don't have any choice. And even an animal that doesn't really flock, it still has its behavior. You know, your dog has its dog behavior, and it can't it can't be anything else other than a dog. And that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But nonetheless, it is what it is. And it there is no right and wrong, per se, in the same way, you know, for an animal. You know, one animal commits, or, you know, it kills the other one. It's not murder. It's just an animal killing an animal, you know, and they kill each other for food or so on and so forth. But they don't, you know, they're hungry. They want to eat. And that's their food. So they're not, they don't kill in the same way human beings do, for example. So human beings, we have this... more than just intelligence, we have this this problem of knowing the difference between right and wrong. And that really comes down to the sort of the crux of what defines us as individuals, what defines us as human beings. And so, but we have this choice. It's not, you know, animals don't have any choice. We as human beings have a choice. We're not forced to accept this identity, this God-given identity. We're not forced to accept that. We can reject it. But, you know, and then you get into the idea of original sin and so on and so forth. And so we're, you know, briefly, you know, we're, you know, Adam and Eve, you had the first pair of human beings, and there had to be a first pair of human beings. You had this first pair of human beings, and they were, you know, Adam had this perfect relationship with his creator, and he blew it. You know, because God, you know, whatever it was, God, you know, in the story, and the story is, you know, if you want to take it literally or not, you can just look at the principles of it, but it's very relevant to us today. God says, don't eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. You can have anything else you want except this one thing. Can't have that. Stay away from that. Because if you eat of that, you know, you'll surely die. And so the serpent approached Eve. And then Eve offered the fruit to Adam, the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil to Adam. And Adam, you know, even though God told him he knew better, knew he wasn't supposed to do it, he did it anyway. And then when God confronted him later, he said, well, oh, the woman you gave me, Eve made me do it. You know, blame the woman. Make an excuse, which is even worse. You know, the excuse is worse than the sin. And so Adam and Eve, you know, they were banished from the Garden of Eden, and which is, you know, maybe they were physically banished from a garden, but they were also banished, you know, there's sort of the Garden of Eden is sort of like the Garden of the Mind. They were sort of banished. They were permanently separated because, you know, especially because Adam refused, you know, he made excuse. And so therefore, Adam and Eve's offspring, we, the offspring of Adam and Eve, were sort of born in sin. We're sort of born separated from that potential identity. And so we come into this world sort of wanting to play God. And so it's salvation as a way to, we can be saved from that. But we have to want to be saved. We really have to want it. It's not, you know, it's not some, you know, simple thing. God loves you the way you are and so on. No, he doesn't. He loves you from what you are. So, but we have this potential as human beings. We have this potential. And if you're really a searching person and you're looking for the truth and nothing but the truth will do, then you'll find it. But if not, then you're going to get caught up in whatever else, in a, you know, mess of pottage. You get caught up in that, and you know, you think you're living your life and you're getting your goodies and you're shacking up and you're having all the sex that you want and so on and so forth. You know, having sex and then killing the unwanted byproducts of sex, and, you know, calling it choice when it's murder, killing the baby, killing the unborn child. You know, call it choice and make all kinds of rationalizations. You know, you think you're getting your goodies. At the in reality, your life is meaningless. You've wasted it. Your existence is meaningless. And so, human beings, when you're separated from that God-given identity, and you're sort of tricked, you know, because we come into this world, we're not perfect. We come into this world, you know, with a little malicious intent of our own. And then somebody can come along and just trick us even worse. And it does happen. You will be tempted. Trick you even worse to, you know, make you stumble even more. Make that guilty conscience that could have been your identity, your source of identity, make that into a guilty conscience that you think you have to flee from and run away from, and make you even more guilty so that you'll become even worse, so that you'll devolve as a human being. You'll devolve even more. Human beings are the only creature. Individually, we can devolve. You know, animals, you know, you can say, well, animals, you know, they want to talk about evolution or whatever, you know, which there's all kinds of problems with that, but they try to say, well, the animal's becoming better and it's adapting and so on and so forth. But the problem, you know, human beings, I believe, we can actually devolve individually, or we can evolve individually. We can become better as individuals, or we can become worse. You know, but all it takes is to tempt a child. You know, teach them that wrong is right and right is wrong. Try to make them as comfortable as possible with that. Sort of trick them. Trick someone into sinning. Get them to sin. Get them to commit a sin. Then conscience becomes an enemy. Genuine identity turns into conscience. It's seen as some guilty conscience, and it's just something that society somehow programmed into you. And so therefore, just you can be part of the flock, and there's safety in the flock. Be part of the collective. And basically, it turns you into a Borg. You know, if you're familiar with the Star Trek Next Generation, you know, the idea of the Borg, you know, the Borg collective, that's basically what it turns you into. You lose your identity. But at the same time, you think that you know, the genius of the thing, of the evil, is that you think that you're acting out of your own wishes. You know, you're shacking up because you want to. You're having all the sex that you want because you want to. You're aborting your child because you want to. When all of those actions are coming, it's involuntary. It's involuntary, but you've got the lie. The lie is that you're acting of your own volition, but you're just lying to yourself. And people are very good at, very adept at lying to themselves. And so your life, your existence is a better word. Your existence is meaningless. In the grand scheme of things, it's meaningless. there's only really one thing that can give your existence meaning, and that is awareness. But it's not just awareness of environment or awareness of pleasure or awareness of that type, sort of in a carnal sense. Because that's, you're just an animal. Your dog is aware of its environment. Fish is aware of its environment. A bird is aware of its environment. You know, even an ant or a bee, they're aware of their environment. Common housefly is very much aware of its immediate environment. But it's not aware of what is right and what is wrong. It's simply driven by its instincts. And when I say God-given identity, I know some people, you know, they have their knee-jerk reactions and they think I'm being religious and so on and so forth, and I'm not. And so, you know, this God-given identity, and there's really, what other term can I use? This God-given identity, this creator-given identity that I'm talking about, is to human beings as instinct is to animals. Except we have to want it. We have to long for it. We have to want it. Truly want it. It's not something that's just going to fall in your lap accidentally. Gotta want it. And why some people want it and a lot of people don't seem to want it is a mystery. So if you want to be, you know, you're part of the flock, you know, and you're happy rationalizing your flock thoughts, you got your herd thoughts, herd mentality thoughts, and you're just rationalizing them away, right is wrong, wrong is right. Whatever the group thinks, that's right. Your existence has no meaning. Nobody's going to remember who you are. Nobody's going to remember your ideas. So on and so forth. What we are as human beings, or what we can, the potential that we have is to be, have this, you know, we're infinitesimally small. You know, you look at the scale and the size of the universe and we're as nothing. We're tiny little creatures on a little dust mote. On the beach of an infinite ocean. We're nothing, physically. But we potentially have a very big awareness. And quite frankly, that's why we exist. That's why we were created, to have this awareness. To be able to be aware. Of not only our own existence, but the creation around us. But if you want to be part of the flock and rationalize right and wrong, see the world backwards, then you have no right to complain. You have no standing to complain about the dictatorship that you live under. And it's a bottomless pit. So, anyhow, I want to, I've got more of this book to read of Roy Masters, Gravity Driven Universe. And so now we're, with the last podcast, I ended with part one of the book. And so now we're down to part two. So I'll start reading this, and I don't know how far I'll go, but we'll just kind of play it by ear and see. So this is book two, For Laymen and Philosophers, Finding God Beyond Gravitation. Okay, selection from editor's preface to 1997 edition. And this is a quote from Einstein: "The whole of science is nothing more than a refinement of everyday thinking." And that was Albert Einstein, and his he had a book, Physics and Reality, from 1936. Around the time of the Hubble telescope was sending the world all those thrilling early pictures, opening up grand new vistas for cosmology, I got a phone call from Roy Masters. I was helping him edit his first science book, and Roy was excited to show me something he had discovered that related to his cosmic origin theory. I live only 10 minutes away, so I hopped in my car wondering what it could be. He had mentioned his pool pump, but I couldn't imagine what connection he had drawn between cosmology and a swimming pool. Whatever the idea, I knew it was going to be fun to talk about. When I arrived, Roy was sitting on the base of the diving board, looking down at the deep sunlit water. The high-pressure pump shot an even flow of fresh water into the pool, which caused swirls beneath the surface. But that wasn't what intrigued Roy. He was focusing on shadows cast on the bottom of the pool. They exploded into existence seemingly out of nowhere, a fractured symmetry of shadows, some so black you would think they were caused by a solid object floating on the surface. Roy eagerly pointed out that these myriad shadows were the result of the swirls made by the water flowing evenly into the pool. Some swirls were loose and left fleeting gray shadows. Other swirls were tight spinning and left those dark, solid shadows. That afternoon, we watched a similar display occurring on the bottom of the pool. I can only imagine what we looked like to Roy's grandchildren as we sat by the pool staring down at the water, but for me it was a fascinating poetic moment and typical how of this man theorizes, full of childlike wonder and irrepressible curiosity despite his nearly 70 years of age. The pool analogy didn't have to be perfect. For Roy, the point was simple and beautiful. Out of something invisible, motion alone can create something real enough to cast a shadow. We were both transfixed, watching the shadows on the bottom of the pool suddenly form, sometimes join, live and die in an organic display of force made tangible, something apparently coming from nothing. Of course, apparently is the operative word. That's Robert Just, from November 1997. Chapter 1, Where Knowledge Ceases. And this is a quote from St. Thomas Aquinas. "It is certain and evident to our senses that in the world of some things are in motion. Now whatever is moved by another, for nothing can be in motion except that it is in potentiality to that towards which it is moved. Whereas a thing moves inasmuch as it is in act, it is therefore impossible that in the same respect and in the same way a thing could be both mover and moved, i.e., that it could move itself. Therefore, whatever is moved must be moved by another. But this cannot go on into infinity, because then there would be no first mover, and consequently no other mover. Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at the first mover, moved by no other, and this everyone understands to be God. And that was from St. Thomas Aquinas. When theologian Thomas Aquinas was on his deathbed, his assistant pleaded with him to finish his last book. Aquinas said, "I cannot." Urged once again, Aquinas said, "All that I have written is like chaff to me." And then he explained the mystical value of knowledge in his search for God. That which is not known cannot be loved. Knowledge, therefore, is not to be loved for itself, but is meant to lead to that which must be loved. When he whom is to be loved is found by virtue of knowledge, knowledge ceases. Because people used to believe that the earth was flat, mariners were afraid to sail beyond the horizon for fear of falling off the edge of the world. The authorities of that age were also convinced that the earth was flat. They rejected theories that stated otherwise, and they were certainly not interested in proof that they were wrong. 20th century scientists who assume a godless universe are like those authorities of old who believed in a flat earth. The more evidence points to a universal design and therefore a designer, the more these kinds of scientists become petrified and frozen in their 20th century belief system. Although modern physicists have studied the mysteries of the photon, electron, and quark, they are now stuck at the border of the greater mystery, the source of all this energy. Many are simply afraid to see there is more to science than knowledge of the facts, afraid to delve honestly into the metaphysics of physics. If God exists, then he must have created science, and thus honest scientific inquiry will lead directly back to him. The 20th century has revealed many remarkable discoveries, from Einstein's theory of relativity to quantum physics, all edging us closer to understanding the origin of the universe. Generations of modern physicists probe deeper into the mysteries of nature's building blocks, and each time these physicists thought they fully understood their discovery. But then startling revelations led to the next generation still deeper into the mysteries of atomic and subatomic particles. There is small, smaller, and smallest, and then nothing, or so these physicists say, just a passive void in the vast micro-interior, which is part of the vast macro-exterior, void of space. But how can super-energized subatomic complexities be a spawn of a passive nothing? Many physicists attribute universal force to a big explosion of some kind. But whatever the original energizing force is, two things must be true about it. First, something caused it, and that something has to be pre-physical or metaphysical. And second, that pre-physical cause must be the basis for all of the physical laws of the universe. In other words, it must be the ultimate relative. All creation must be the expression of the Creator. The next generation of physicists must take a final scientific step and face only the only thing left that truly exists beyond the theoretical void, the reality of God himself. His living universe is not a void space, but rather a force of primordial energy continually flowing throughout the universe. Like the authorities of Columbus's day, most modern scientists do not listen enough to that still small voice within, the same voice that urged Columbus on that unseeable way he followed despite his own fears. Columbus had vision, a knowing faith compelling him to go beyond. He knew without knowing why he knew, and he acted, not completely understanding the hand that pressed him forward. This quality of vision, faith, will be needed to create the new physics of the next century, needed to take that step into the unknown so that it might be known. However, in this final voyage, we have no vessel, as Columbus did, to transport us, No compass to guide us, no tangible destination to verify our theory. How then shall we proceed? Shall we cringe on shore, staring at the horizon, stopped at the threshold of this ultimate adventure just because we cannot see, or prove what lies out there? Or shall we venture forth unafraid, sailing a theoretical vessel into the unknown of new physics? Unlike the physics of the great philosopher-scientists, like Albert Einstein and others before him, modern physics tends to limit itself to mathematical calculations as the pathway to discovery. Yet, what physicists study as creation is only the physical phenomenon rather than its nomenon or cause of the phenomenon. The nomenon of a God-created universe is unfathomable to a secular scientist, just as a mountain climber can reach the top of a mountain but having no wings can go no further. So also are many physicists ill-equipped to scale the reality of the originating other dimension. Their typically mathematical approach to the time-space-matter relationship cannot penetrate the nomenon of the before-now, the other-dimensional reality before time. The purely mathematical mind cannot cross this border. Neither can those who practice the more empirical methods of discovery. Instruments of science are made of subatomic particles. They can only measure what they know, in other words, that what they are themselves, the beyond, is beyond them. Once we stand at the border of the beyond, staring out over the very edge of creation, we need more than empirical study and ordinary theory. We need the very highest and purest form of scientific enlightenment. Speaking to us through that still small voice, God guides our intuitive mind across the dimensional border to a deep comprehension of His magnificent creation and His ultimate principles. In the final analysis, mathematical formulas and scientific instruments cannot go where the soul can venture. Currently, physics stands just about as close to the edge as it can get, having followed the cosmological trail of relative effects and causes. We have traced our physical reality almost all the way back to its source, yet we shrink from this source, looking for more superficial causes and effects, more knowledge. We avoid the philosophically obvious that there must be an ultimate uncaused cause, a permanent root, simplicity that relates to the physical universe just as a mathematical zero gives reality to the one, and together they cause the whole complexity of mathematics to be born. At the beginning of the 20th century, Einstein began his journey of relatives, but he did not finish his voyage into the unknown dimension. Now, as our knowledge increases, as we chart the 21st century, physics needs to take on a religious quest because at the core of Einstein's profound theories, there is a missing relative. The aim of this book is to seek out this missing relative that unifies physics, to seek out this simplicity that explains the science it created. Chapter 2. Big Bang's Little Problem. This is a quote from astrophysicist Robert Jastrow. For the scientist who has lived by faith in the power of his reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a small band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. And that was Robert Jastrow, astrophysicist. The fact that the universe appears to be expanding leads cosmologists to conclude the universe was created by a hot explosive event they call the Big Bang. However, there are some questions with regard to this theory, beginning with the little problem of the singularity, that infinitely dense, infinitely hot mass which science says caused the explosion. How did it get there in the first place? And where did all that heat come from? And then there's the problem of time. When did it exist and how? In the process of considering these and other limitations of a hot bang theory, Another possibility of creation comes to mind, a cold bang that requires no pre-bang mass or time, but simply requires God. Science says, rightly in my view, that the universe is expanding, but even with our light-sensitive technology, how do we really know? If we are indeed peering across billions of light-years of space, as they say, looking backwards into time at light reaching our telescopes from an expanding universe, then is it not possible that the expansion we see coming from the past is no longer happening back there right now? What is happening out there in the distant galaxies will surely not be seen for another few billion years. So how can we be so sure of an ever-expanding universe merely by observation? What we see now is really ancient history. For all we know, the universe could already be collapsing. I'm only trying to make the point that there are some things in science that cannot be fathomed by calculation based on observation. Observation as scientific technique cannot go far enough. It needs the partner of Einsteinian intuitive observation, looking through the mind's eye based on sound philosophical theory, establishing the principles, which then can be confirmed through scientific observation. Pure scientific observation is not enough to complete the cosmological quest. Telescopes which can only register starlight reaching us now from billions of years ago cannot possibly know what is happening to those stars where they are now. It is not that telescopes are wrong in what they observe, they are just physically too time-bound. Of course, empirical research in cosmology is always physically time-bound and thus always limited. The startling reality of Einstein's achievements is that he leaped ahead of the empirical science through his unique intuitive approach. His inspired deductive powers gave mankind an understanding far ahead of mere mortal observation. The reason Einsteinian science is so important as a partner to observation is that there is a natural limit to human observation, a barrier beyond which we cannot go. Because we are time-bound, there is a limit to what we can see, and thus Einsteinian second sight, not being time-bound, can penetrate the natural barrier of space, time, and fathom mysteries that elude our telescopes. At the risk of belaboring the point, let me put this another way. What if there were an astronomer on some far-flung planet in space, billions of light years away, looking at us with our light that has traveled all that distance in time to him? Could he not conclude that our movement is away from him due to light's redshift? Could he not be under the same impression as we are in perceiving a young universe in its early stages? So which way is the past, and which way is out? It's all relative to who does the looking. There is no way of knowing by observation what is happening out there now. As far as the past and future are concerned, it is not possible to know about a beginning from our frame of reference. We simply don't know where it is or which way it is. It matters not that we on Earth are moving out with this so-called universal expansion. The fact remains that we are looking out at billions of years of ancient cosmological events, and they, if alien astronomers exist, looking back at us, would see us as nearer to the beginning of the creation event. Now the universe may well be expanding, but as I said, some things cannot ever be known by calculation from observation, simply because a calculation based upon such things as which way is past is flawed. Questioning the Big Bang Theory. Let us look at the basic problem of an atheistic Big Bang creation theory, which begins with something infinitely dense and infinitely hot, whatever that means, with no explanation about what reality is, whence it came, or how it actually came into being. It is claimed that the entire universe sprang from what physicists call singularity, perhaps something only as large as the period at the end of this sentence. Whatever the size, the very concept of an entire and already existing something, large or small, is a contradiction in terms of science and a real beginning. None of the laws of science would have existed. There was no such thing as size, dimension, mass, time, length, depth, width, heat, not to mention the dynamics of what they call a bang. A mass of infinite density, infinite temperature, infinitely small and compressed, is an already existing creation. So we must ask ourselves this question. What is this thing, infinitely small, dense, and hot, that already existed before the Big Bang? From where did it come, and how did it exist without time and space in which to exist? Nothing can exist in this dimension without space-time to precede its existence. Order to chaos to order? A clump of infinite density cannot possibly explain creation. Who or what made this lump so compressed when it was unleashed or unlocked, it exploded into the infinite expanse of the universe? What is the mechanism that triggered the bang? Again, we are alluding to laws of science that didn't yet exist. And what is the underlying law of chaotic explosion like the bang? Can lightning strike a junkyard and create a brand new Mercedes? Where is the meaning, unfolding order, the scientific progression of causes and effects? A Big Bang is an explosive, destructive thermodynamic event. It is a blowing up, a flying apart process. It is a breaking up or down process. It is an expanding descent from order to chaos, from hot to cold. According to the laws of thermodynamics, we should be going from efficiency to inefficiency, leading to a dying universe. I'm not saying that the laws of thermodynamics don't apply, they just don't apply to the initial process of creation. But what process am I really describing? Behold, creation made of an endless procession of wonders. Not a universe breaking down, but one coming together, unfolding logically from one principle into another, hydrogen becoming stars, and stars giving light as they change their hydrogen fuel into heavier elements, the substance of which planets and living things here on Earth are made. And before hydrogen, a similar process of unfolding, creating the tiniest particles, the building blocks of the elements themselves, and all flowing a pattern, following a pattern formed out of an initial orderly creative principle rather than a destructive chaotic event. The Big Bang time problem. The problem of time is twofold. First, for a Big Bang creation event to happen, time would have to precede the event. The question is, how does it do that? What is the dynamic that would cause the existence of time before any creation event? Scientists are not clear on this question. They have another problem with time. In their concept of a Big Bang creation event, the bang would cause time wind to ripple or blow in an outward motion from the center of the explosion. In other words, although omnidirectional from a center frame of reference, from our point of view of time would have to be consistently one-directional, and yet I believe I can show time as a consistently omnidirectional wind, meaning it comes from all directions at once, the effect being that time predictably slows down as we move in any particular direction. If the Big Bang model were true, the effect on time would be quite different. The reason is that if time were one-directional, you were driving with the time wind in the same direction, time would begin to slow down as you caught up with the time wind. However, if you traveled in the opposite direction towards the Big Bang center, then the time wind would have to blow harder against you, and hence time would move faster relative to you. This does not happen. A clock ticks consistently slower in every direction that one chooses to travel through space. Therefore, time cannot be one-directional. Furthermore, how can we explain a Big Bang creation event without time preceding it? Events can happen only in time. Were there no time, there could be no procession of causes and effects. For a Big Bang to occur, time had to precede the event, and that's impossible. Why? Because even if it did exist before the explosion, how could time escape the phenomenal gravity that would inevitably result from such an inexplicably dense mass? So dense, in fact, that it is not really mass as we know it. Consider the mind-boggling gravity of a black hole, believed to be a star collapsed in on itself. This pales by comparison to the original density we are discussing. And yet, a black hole is supposed to be mass of such inconceivable density that compression, that a teaspoon of such matter might weigh 5 million tons on Earth. If its gravity is so powerful that everything, matter, light, even time itself, gets sucked in, disappearing down a drain hole where all known laws of science cease and nothing more happens. But no matter how dense a black hole might be, and they say there are quasars that can swallow whole galaxies, nothing that we know could possibly compare with the gravitational pull of that mythical, original singularity that supposedly caused the Big Bang. What physicists describe as infinitely hot, infinitely compressed, infinitely dense, unimaginably small, etc., this pre-bang density would have a gravity of such magnitude that nothing could possibly escape it, not even time. What pushing out force can overcome such a pulling in gravity? Of course, all of this theorizing ignores the simple question, who or what created the original density? Something already created certainly can't be called a creation event. Clearly, they are saying that the universe had a beginning, but then by all logic it should have a beginner, an uncreated creator. After all, the laws of science are profoundly suggestive of an ordering mind, and yet science keeps leaving him out of the event by starting the universe with an already existing lump. Is the lump itself to be considered the prime mover of all existence and maker of the laws thereof? Can you seriously imagine all the profound complexities of the universe coming from a mindless lump? Universal geometry of motion and stillness. This book is about creation through an energy field scintillating in the darkness, creating out of what appears to be a nothing before time began. Black holes are not necessarily destructive, rather they may be expressions of creation happening billions of years ago, witnessed now through our telescopes. Creation, I say, is a geometric symphony, an endless variation of motions and stillnesses. Here the word nothing is quite precise because matter is composed of an extra-dimensional no-thing, yet-to-be things. The key principle presented here is that matter and the progression of matter are made of an unrolling variation of one geometrical theme. Original motion and stillness energy and apparent absence of energy, while motion can exist only with a relative stillness to define it, perfect creation stillness is able to exist without motion. All other stillnesses are relative stillnesses, which is to say they are in motion. All of the building blocks of nature have some kind of nucleus center that is relatively still compared with motions around it. Just as these relatively still centers are essential for the existence of matter, so is a perfect inertial center also essential for the existence of the whole universe. If the universe is in motion, and we know it is, then there must be an absolute rest to define that motion. This absolute stillness, surrounded by the all of absolute motion, establishes a pattern followed by the rest of the universal building blocks from atoms to planets. Atoms and planets involve relative motions with relative stillnesses at their centers. However, in the case of the creation event, this still center is not relative but must be a pivotal point of absolute rest. The absolute rest center, the unmoved mover of all things that are created and that move. Can a solar system exist as a complete whole without a central and relatively still sun? Would it remain a solar system? Obviously not. Can wheels turn without an axle? Can atoms exist without their nuclei? Would they remain atoms? No, they would be reduced to something less than themselves. Everything orbits, cycles, or circles around some kind of center event cause. Even plants and other living things revolve in life and death cycles. Can you think of anything in your life or this universe that doesn't involve such a system? Even man's life ought to revolve around and be centered in his Creator. The redeemed, spiritually inbreathed man, God-centered, manifests the ultimate physical and metaphysical cycle, the living, breathing poetry of ultimate motion and rest. The question once again is, can this universe in absolute motion exist with an absolute inertial rest without an absolute inertial rest to define it? In the context of Einstein's theory, the answer is no, for in his view, nothing can be considered to be in motion unless it's compared to something relatively at rest. Plato said that time and the succession of change is the moving image of eternity. According to number, the absolute place of universal stillness, which gave birth to original motion, is the model from which all relative motions and relative stillnesses derive. Without these centers of relative stillness defining the motions that become the geometric progression called creation, a universe made of infinite variety of interconnecting, spinning, orbiting, revolving, winding gravity winds, there could be no creation. The geometry of one. The ancient Greek mathematician Pythagoras maintained that one is not a number, but the underlying continuum initially containing and giving birth to all numbers, and that one is the underlying unity and starting point for all systems, the root nature of all things, ourselves, the earth, and the universe. Modern science confirms his mathematics of creation. Of what, may we ask, are the elements comprised? Numbers, atomic numbers. A hydrogen atom differs in properties from a lead atom only because its nuclear properties differ, meaning that the number of moons, or electrons, that are moving in their orbitals about a nucleus composed of an equal number of positively charged protons. The essences themselves aren't different, only their charge and their numbers. The energy essence that makes up the electrons of the hydrogen atom is the same as the essence of those lead atoms. Electrons are electrons in both, and the same with the protons and neutrons of the nucleus. It is only the numbers that change the properties of their respective elements, giving them spectacular new forms and functions. From the giant redwood tree to a sparkling diamond. What I am saying is that the first one in the beginning, everything is everything else in a creation symphony, a geometry of never-ending complex orbiting numbers, just as Pythagoras's never-ending complexity of numbers developed out of the simplicity of one. It is the geometric growth of one added to itself and so on in a spectacular creative flow and not a bang produced by a lump. So I think I'm going to stop there. So whenever I begin again, we'll be ready for chapter 3. So anyway, I think I'm going to go ahead and bring this to a close. We're about to hit 1 hour here. And so I need to get this uploaded and get headed to bed and then I'm gonna finish making my little video and get that uploaded to YouTube. So hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.